Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Amy Small. Amy is the Executive Director of the Texas State Law Library. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me today.
Some of our listeners may have seen you in some of your CLE presentations that you've done, but just give us a little bit of background on you and kind of how you got to the job that you are now.
So I have actually worked here since 2007. I started as a librarian. It was my first job out of library school. And when I went to library school, at the time, I didn't know what kind of library I wanted to go into. So I kind of cast my net very wide and was fortunate to get a job at the law library. At the time, the sort of philosophy was that I had customer service experience and I had some technology experience that maybe couldn't be trained as easily as legal research was. So even though I didn't have any legal background at the time, they gave me a shot and I really liked it. I was fortunate that they liked me. And since then, I've held a variety of positions here. So at this point, I've been exposed to a lot of the different functions and services that the library offers. We do a whole lot of stuff that people might not know about. So I've been an electronic services librarian, which meant that I managed some of our databases and I did a little bit of coding for our internal app. I managed our inmate copy service. We do a lot of correspondence with people who are incarcerated in the Department of Criminal Justice prisons, helping them access their appellate records, file writs, those sorts of things. So I helped with that, did the finances here. And then for the past, I guess it's now 3 years, I forget whether it's been 3 or 4 years, but I've been the director. So all of that experience helping people find legal information, understanding what people are looking for, and specifically people of all kinds. We do serve the whole state and everybody in it. You don't have to be an attorney to use our library. So we do have a lot of everyday people coming to us with questions about the law. At the same time, we directly serve the high courts. So we have a specific legislative mandate to serve the Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals, and the appellate courts. So with that, we have a wide variety of people that we help. And so we have a wide variety of items and types of item in our collection. Everything from literally wills for dummies to D'Orsayneaux, you know, treatises from British law treatises in our archives from the 1700s, everything in between. I'm lucky that I really enjoy what we do. I find it really interesting. And over the past few years, I've tried to do a better job of getting out to the community and saying, hey, you might not know that we're here and you might not know all of this stuff that we have for you that is free. So making sure that people know that this is a tool available to them to utilize in their practices.
Let's start with a basic question. Where is the State Law Library? If someone wants to come, where do they go?
Absolutely. So we're in the Capitol Complex in downtown Austin. We are sort of in a building that got glued on to the Supreme Court building in the 90s.
Accurate,
yeah. And there are leaks in the building where we got glued on, where it wasn't. So you can tell exactly where the addition was. But the brief history of the library is that we were originally the library for the Supreme Court, created in the 1850s, very shortly after the Supreme Court was created. And so we've kind of, you know, been obviously for a long time, we were part of the Supreme Court, but due to circumstances, funding, staffing, it became apparent in the 1960s that it would be more efficient for us to break off as a separate agency. So we did so. 1972, we officially became our own independent agency, but we still have the really strong ties to the court. So we're right next door to the Third Court of Appeals. We're in sort of the same building as the Court of Criminal Appeals and the Supreme Court, and we're kind of catty corner diagonal from the Texas Law Center. We're open to the public 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. Anybody is free, welcome to come in and use all of our resources that we have here.
So you don't have to have a library card or any sort of subscription to show up and use it?
No. If you would like to use our computers, you need a free library account, but you can sign up for one of those online. free. It's simple. If you want to check out books, you're more than welcome. We ask for a little bit more information in that case, address where we can contact you if you abscond with our materials. But we also, that's not even necessary because we do have free scanners that everyone can use. Some of them have document feeders. So for those nice loose leaf materials, you can just stick it in and scan. I do want to stress also that we want to be accessible as possible to the population. You know, Austin has a large deaf population and a large blind population. And so we have resources so that people with disabilities can still use our materials. We have a book scanner that will scan and either speak it back to you or actually record an MP3 that you can email to yourself. It's so cool. We just got it a few years ago and it's awesome. And we also have screen magnifiers and text magnifiers so that if you have some vision, you can magnify the text. Same on the computers. So we are open and willing to help anyone of all abilities.
Is it still possible, Amy, to do what I used to do in my first experiences in your library and make a good old-fashioned copy of a page out of a book?
We do still have a copy machine. It is less utilized than, because I remember, you know, when I first started, firms would send couriers all the time to come in and make copies of the appellate records from the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. And we don't see that all these days, but that used to be, you know, a brisk business for us. So if you want, you can make a copy. Also have a copy service where if you don't want to make the trip, you can give us a call. We'll request the file from the court of those three high courts and then email it to you or send you the physical copies if you prefer that.
Wow, that's great service. I wish I'd known about that, you know, 20 years ago.
Yes, saved you some time and yeah, effort, I'm sure.
I can't wait to come in and try one of those scanners though.
They're really cool. And you know, this is sort of getting a little bit in the weeds, but one of them has a thumb eraser so that if you're copying a big book and have to use your thumbs to press the pages down, it'll take that out and make it look a little bit cleaner, more pro.
If we could find a place to record on location there, we might just have to do that.
Yeah, there you go.
Todd, I think we're going to have to do a podcast field trip the next time I'm in Austin. We're going to have to come in and...
That's another resource that our library offers. We have a conference room that can be reserved by members of the public or attorneys at small firms, maybe, who don't have a meeting room. If you need to record a deposition, we have that on our website. You can see the calendar and make a reservation.
That is kind of transitioning into the next thing I want to talk about, which is what are the resources that you offer? I mean, there's a lot of lawyers that have kind of their set things that they do in their office, or maybe they have a local law library, but what are some things that are available at the state law library that lawyers may not realize are there, or they might realize they can get through the state law library?
The first thing I think worth mentioning is that, you know, a lot of people here that were based in Austin and say, well, that's great, but I'm in El Paso or I'm in Lubbock. What did that do for me? That same question was posed over and over, specifically when we went to the legislature to ask for money to keep continuing and saying, well, you're purportedly a state agency, but you're only in Austin. What can you do for the rest of the state? So we really took that to heart, like I said, about 10, 15 years ago, and started talking to publishers at that time to see if they would let us make our resources available electronically and remotely. This was really new at the time. It was pretty novel. I don't know of any other libraries, law libraries, that were doing that. These days, it's pretty common. I think COVID really pushed people towards that, but we had it already set up. And so there's really a wealth of resources there that even if you have a library in your office or a county law library or university law library that you go to, you might see different things online through our resources than, you know, that might complement or supplement what you have available to you now. One of the best things that I really like to sing the praises of is our library of legal periodicals, so law journals, law reviews, and then we also have a portion for bar journals that is available through a website called Hine Online. You know, we used to get the law journals in print and law reviews, and they take up a lot of shelf space. They're very expensive. You know, as pointed out, they're only accessible here in Austin. So Hine is, I think they're like a family-run company, and they are preservation and digitization minded, and they are completists. So what they do is they take the actual print copies of all these law reviews, scan them exactly as they appear in paper, so it's adequate for citation, and make it available through this database. They will not post something, to my knowledge, unless they have the complete run. So you can be sure that the very first issue going up to the very most current issue that they can have access to based on embargoes and things will be available through that. So if you are looking for an obscure law review article, a really old one, those are oftentimes available through Hine Online. It's something like 9,000 titles or 9,000. It's just an incredible, just comprehensive legal periodical resource.
So how do you access, like, I'm familiar with Hine, and I remember it, I think you could have a direct subscription to Hine at one point, maybe you still can. How do you access that through the State Law Library?
For all of our online resources, you just need to sign up for a library account. And if you go to our website, which is www.sll.texas.gov, one of the first links that you'll see, we've got a quick links box that has kind of the most popular things that people want. There's a button that says get a library account. And one thing that I will point out is that when we were first starting this program, one of the agreements that our vendors asked us to make to them was that we would put some sort of constraints on the user base, just so every attorney in the world all of a sudden wasn't having free access to this. So they asked us to limit it just to people who are in Texas. And the way that we determine that is if you come in person, we look for an ID or a piece of mail. But online, we use a geolocation feature. So unfortunately, we do run into this where an attorney's licensed in Texas, reside elsewhere, you know, practices in Texas. We can't give an account in that situation. If you are in Texas, you sign up for a library account. With that one login, you have access to everything on our website, including Hine Online, eBooks. You know, we have a lot of specialty databases as well. We have a really popular immigration law database, but the two big ones are eBooks and Hine Online. We also offer Fastcase, but you have access to that through membership in the bar. So that's not as, I think, exciting as the eBooks really are one of the main draws for, I think, practicing attorneys.
Gosh, I can think of so many uses for that, things that I would probably go and try to get my hands on. Doing it myself would take a lot of effort. We lawyers sometimes forget that, and I'm here in Austin, I have no excuse. I mean, Jody's in Fort Worth, so he at least has the excuse of, well, you're in Austin, what can you do for me? But gosh, just knowing that that's available online, it's as easy as signing up for a library account, that you just opened up a whole new world of possibilities for me and my research.
And I think even more to the point, you know, about ease of access and efficiency, we have a whole staff of librarians who are waiting for your emails and your calls. If you are to say, I need this law review article, I need this citation, I need something on this, I need this old CLE article, we're happy to pull that and send it to you. Even beyond being able to access and research yourself, know that that's significant tool and resource that we make available are our researchers here.
How much help can attorneys get from the researchers?
So we won't do case law research, but we are happy to either recommend resources. If you're sort of indicating to us that you are wanting to look into a topic in depth, we can suggest some starting points for you. And to that end, we have put together a guide containing our recommended theories, ebook, and books. So if you're coming to us and saying, where are your intellectual property materials? We can point you to that, and it's going to have a lot of great starting points. So it might be excellent overviews. It might be sort of the most renowned titles on a topic, but we'll get you started with that. Otherwise, you know, you can come to us and say, I'm looking for information about how to accomplish XYZ. We'll check the resources that we're familiar with that we know may address that and say, here's a chapter from this resource discussing what you're looking for. If we can't find something that really kind of seems to hit on exactly what you're looking for, what we might do is send you a table of contents and say, here's a resource that we think may be helpful for you. If you want to identify some of these sections that look like of most interest, we're happy to send those along. But typically, sort of help identifying resources, maybe help determining a search strategy. You know, if you're working in Lexis or Westlaw from home and aren't getting the results you want and want to see if we can suggest maybe how to refine it further, we're happy to do that. Always happy to pull citations for you because we have access either through our specific collection or our professional networks, you know, where we can put out feelers to see if someone else, a neighboring library perhaps, has something that you're looking for.
For most clients, supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. What's at stake can be very significant. Very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds, so it's important to work with a company that knows the ins and outs of the process.
If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, contact Court Surety Bond Agency today.
In terms of the search parameters, are y'all using like the full AI capable features in Lexis and Westlaw?
So they will not allow us to make that available for our patron use yet, because we do also offer free Westlaw and Lexis access on our public computers. So that's another perk. If you're in the Austin area, sign up for a library account, you're welcome to come use our Westlaw and Lexis for free. They won't give us that yet. And then in our professional subscriptions for the librarians, we have not chosen to integrate that yet, typically because we're not doing the kind of advanced searching on a patron's behalf that really would make that most useful. Both systems are starting to integrate types of AI into the searching a little bit. There's some extractive AI that allows you to do a little bit more natural language searching, which comes in our subscriptions. But the things that they're really selling, like the brief writer, you know, we don't write briefs here, so we don't have any use for that. I think that there's a document comparison feature in Lexis, which is really interesting that we do have access to. But I think the really powerful AI tools are really more geared towards practicing attorneys and stuff that we don't do on behalf of patrons.
What are the types of things that you see the heaviest use in your library?
Definitely our eBooks. And even, I really wish we could make these available remotely, but you know, the vendors just haven't really opened that door for us yet. But the O'Connor's books, all of the O'Connor's, they're so popular for a very good reason. You know, we have copies that can be checked out. Like I said, you can use the scanners. The copies that can be checked out often never come back. And people love them, and rightfully so. You know, they're super easy to use. They're very accessible. I would love it. I think it would make so many people's day across the state if we could make that available remotely. But we do have them available electronically through Westlaw in the library. So there's that. But then also our historical statutes are another thing that when people learn about them, they get a lot of heavy use, because that's a question we get a lot, you know, almost on a daily basis, is what did X statute read as of X date?
Yeah, that's something I specifically wanted to ask you about and make sure you talked about, because I have been down that road. Jenny has too, no doubt, but there's a lot of us that go down that road. And as we all know, our legislature is very active and statutes get amended, and you buy the latest O'Connor's version of CPRC or whichever, and it doesn't have that old text in it anymore. And sometimes you need to know, because the law has changed over and the old law applies to your case. I was going to compliment you and the state library on that historical Texas statutes service, because I happened to find that on my own about a year ago, and it made it so easy to find the old statutory text. And I did also discover that I think it goes back to, there's like a date cutoff in there somewhere. It was, I think my notes say, if it was amended after January 1 of 2004, then there's another service that's available too that would overlap with that. But between the statutes by date site, which is one of the ones I found, and the historical Texas statutes collection, which you all have available, it was amazing. I mean, you can go back basically as far as you wanted to go in terms of legislative history on a stat, not legislative history like floor debates or things like that, but the actual statutory language. Those changes are not lost to history at all. They're very findable, and that's an extremely useful resource.
Yeah, I think that there's only between, like you said, what's on our website. So probably about 15 years ago, we have this great print collection that I think we've established is perhaps the only complete one, the old versions of all the old laws. And we approached the publisher at the time to see if they would give us permission to digitize them and post them online. And because they are unannotated, they agreed, because there's no material in there that they hold copyright to. So they gave us the permission. We were fortunate to receive a few grants from like the Texas Bar Foundation and I believe the Austin Bar Foundation to have them professionally digitized and then post them on the website. So going from 1879 to 1984 is what's on our website. Statutes by date picks up at 2004. And then if you have access to Westlaw or Lexis between them, I think that there's only about 2 years where there's not some sort of form of them online. And to be honest, I haven't looked at the range that Westlaw and Lexis cover recently. They've been kind of working backwards. So it's very possible that we're all caught up to date. But, you know, because we realize that people really need to do that research and sometimes they actually need to come and dig around in the books, we made some changes to how our collection is displayed and presented to the public this past year. We used to have all of the old superseded base volumes in the basement, and the public couldn't get down there. And, you know, we bound the pocket parts and they were in another place, and the session laws were in another place. And so you kind of had to run around our library and call a librarian to pull the base volume up for you. So last year, we finally put everything together in one place so that the public can come in and have access to all the parts that they need if they wish to do that research on their own. So now that's on the second floor of our library on the mezzanine. You'll find, I believe, the annotated statute base volumes go back to 1910 or 1920. We started saving all of the pocket parts starting in 1981. Bind them every year and have them available. So you can get together with the session laws, you can get really, really granular and pin it down to a certain date. Some of your listeners may not have ever used a pocket part.
That's true.
I was going to go there. That was my question. It's like, does anybody even know what a pocket part is anymore?
It's really funny because, you know, when I do tours and I show people, here are the statutes in print, and I show that here are the pocket parts and here is the literal pocket in the book that they go to, you can see they're like, oh. But whenever we have new librarians start here, I train everybody in print first. So because not only do we have some of these old resources that you have to know the mechanics of them, but I also think it's really critical to understanding how the databases are put together. If you understand where they came from, you know, they're replications of these print resources, and understanding how the print resource works and is compiled, I think really helps you understand what the database is doing. And it's not just putting words in and then they magically appear, you know? So all of our librarians, we start in print and then move to the databases later, just so that we know we're actually understanding the theory behind why these books are assembled the way that they are.
I'm still chuckling about pocket parts.
I remember learning about it in law school. The first time I saw an actual pocket, I realized, oh, okay, now I get what they're talking about. It makes sense.
Yeah, it's also really funny. Your listeners have also maybe never done loose leaf updates. You've got a binder with, you know, loose leaf pages that are put in there. And then to update them, you got a list of take this page, pull it out, and put in the new one. And, you know, librarians, of course, have like a love for books. And so whenever I train them and I say, you rip this page out and you throw it away, sometimes they're like, really? That's what we do? That's how that works.
That's how Dorsanio's was when I started practicing. What are some ways that, and this is near and dear to Todd's heart, but solo and small firm lawyers, what are some ways that you guys can kind of help level the playing field and maximize for them?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely all of these extremely expensive resources that we make available. So Lexis and Westlaw in the library, but even beyond that, our collection of eBooks. There are a lot of really, really powerful practice treatises and practice guides in there. So Dorsanio's, for example, the litigation guide, that is actually one title that is kind of reserved for government employees only. That was another thing that our vendors wanted, that this was their, you know, sort of crown jewel that they wanted to protect a little bit. That said, there are many other publications that kind of reprint the chapters of Dorsanio's that you can check out. So a subscription to Dorsanio's every year is super expensive, and a solo is probably not going to be able to, you know, put those resources towards it. Like I said, we're happy to send sections. You can find a lot of that in different sort of sectioned out eBooks that we offer. So, you know, always feel like you can ask the librarian and say, I'm looking for this information about from Dorsanio's. We can either potentially send you like the task from it, or we can say, if you want to read more, this is replicated in, you know, Dorsanio's pretrial or, you know, appellate. But yeah, I think that that is one of the things that all of these expensive, high value, detailed sources we have here that can give you the tools to put you on that same level as someone who's at a big firm with librarians who are pulling that information for them. We have just anything you can think of. We have jury charges. We have pattern depositions. We have legal encyclopedias. We have federal practice and procedure, just in everything in between. CLEs, you know, online from 2017 forward, so you don't even need to ask us, but then in print going back to the 80s. So these are all things that a small firm or solo shouldn't have to spend money on, because we are already spending that money for you.
Yeah, to that point, I was thinking, you know, sometimes I'm a Westlaw subscriber and I've got a lot of stuff included within my subscription, but sometimes there's something out of plan that I think might be really useful to look at, but I don't know that I really want to push the button and say, accept the charge. And you're making me think, Amy, maybe the next time that happens, I'll have to look and see if that resource is available through the state law library.
You know, a lot of that stuff, whether it's Wright & Miller or Moore's or something, that's through Lexis, but we have that in print. So even if it's outside of your electronic subscription, our print collection does a really good job of supplementing that. I know a lot of people want to believe that everything is available online, and a lot is, but we still make sure that we're maintaining a print collection for sort of those reasons, either accessibility or licensing restrictions. You know, it allows us to make it available in another form.
What are some ways that lawyers can improve their research efficiency using you guys that maybe they don't think about or even know about?
This is one of my favorite topics, is that even if you are an experienced researcher, you may not be using some of the really cool features of some of these databases to their fullest extent. So here's where I will want to share my screen.
We're going to commit a podcast sin and do a visual discussion on here, but we're going to take clips of this and post them on our socials. And maybe if there's a way to make it available on YouTube or something, we can do that too.
Oh, it'll be visible on YouTube. If Amy shares her screen, we will make sure that it is fully visible on YouTube.
So this is an ebook that is part of what we call our digital collection or our ebooks. And it's available through a platform called Overdrive, which you may be familiar with through your public library. University libraries offer it, but it's just an ebook platform that has a lot of built-in features that I don't think that people are maximizing. This is an ebook that I have checked out. So what I'm going to do is go into the text by clicking the read button here, and it looks just like a normal book. And one thing that you will see here is that I just checked this book out today, but it already has highlighting in it. And that is left over from the last time that I checked it out and made note. What I kind of want to stress is that even when you return an ebook from us, even if you forgot about it and it gets automatically returned, your research is not lost. It stays there. And it's not just highlighting. There are several different ways to really kind of maximize how you're making your notes and organizing your research. So the first is if you click on this highlighter little guy up at the top, you will see that there is like a dozen different colors. And this is run through LexisNexis, and their reps always say that's one of the feedback that they get, is that more colors, more colors. So there are a lot of colors. It can be really useful because if you're working on several different things at once, you can highlight in different colors depending on what applies to what. And it lets you organize then based on highlight color. So when you highlight text, I just highlighted a section in peach. My other highlights are in red. If you click on the highlights, you can note that I have made notes to myself, and I can go in and say, you know, I want to come back to this for the brief that I'm writing. And I can make a note about why I highlighted that. I think that I'm sure everyone else has been with me that, you know, you flag a page for yourself or you highlight something and then you come back and you're like, why did I think this was important? I just clicked on my annotation that was highlighted in peach. And so I can make another note. So the note for myself is like, I want to refer to this for this reason. And I'll click done. So then at the top, you'll see this little speech bubble looking thing. And this is a listing of all of the annotations that I have made ever in this book. You can see some are in yellow. It tells me the date that I made that annotation. It gives me the note that I left for myself then. It gives me a little sort of indication as to where in the book it might be. And I can also search and say, was I right looking for anything on mandamus? No. Okay. Where are my habeas notes? So you can search, you know, by keyword there within your notes. Say in theory, I wanted to use red for one client, peach for another. That's great. Okay. So that's all highlighted. Then once I close the book, let's say I return it, I click X. So I'm out of the read view. Looking at the main screen in the digital collection, you will see at the left-hand side some few options, and one of them is my annotation. If we go here, this gives me a list of all of the annotations I've ever made in any book, and I can go in and view them even when I don't have the book checked out. That's what I want to stress the most, is that I don't think people know that this is there, because this still leaves all of your research sort of in one central place. So operating on that assumption that I'm color coding my highlights per client, I've got a yellow one here, I'm going to click that now and say, let's add this to my export queue, which I will show you in a moment. In the book that I was just in, I also had some highlights in yellow. And then you'll see at the left-hand side, just under my annotations, you'll see my export queue. So here are all the things that I've said that I want to take out of here and put into a document to compile. So I only want the yellow ones. So I'm going to click the checkboxes next to all the yellow highlights. Then I'm going to go back up and under actions, I have all these options how to compile this information and export it for use. So if you wanted a spreadsheet so that you can filter, sort, things like that, you can do that. You can also export it just to PDF so that you can email it to somebody. And here, again, keeping in mind, I don't have all of these books checked out right now. It's got the text from the resource that I wanted to note. It's got my notes saying why it was important. And it's got the citation so that you can specifically go back and look at it. This release is also indicating the currency. So if in fact this is a really old annotation that I'd made, it tells me the version of the book that it came from in the event that it's been updated. That's another thing that's worth noting is that the digital library does have past releases. So if you have a site that is, you know, especially for one of these loose leaves where, like I said, we literally rip out the pages, but you need to look back at something that's maybe a couple years old, we can see previous releases. So let's go to this title and I'll show you just real quick.
Can you bookmark different publications there?
You can, you can. So you can, I believe we can go to this and say...
So you bookmark your favorites?
The way that I will do it is I will add tags and I might say... And so once I add a tag, if working on a project and I say these books are all kind of what I want, I can go look at my tags and say, okay, for the CLE that I gave in January that I was working on, these are the books that I ID'd for myself. I also believe that in my books, this will show you what you've downloaded in the past, what you've checked out, what you currently have out under borrowed. So this might also be a way to say that these are the books that I've relied on in the past and I want to come back to. This is the main landing page just for this volume of this series. So, you know, multi-volume set, you can check out individual volumes at a time rather than the whole thing. So here in this sort of main menu, you will see prior releases. You can go back fairly far to see historical changes and versions as of a certain point in time. So I think that's really interesting. Real quickly, another, before I go on, any questions about the sort of research tools within the Lexis Digital Library or other things about this? I just want to spread the gospel of knowing that you can save these notes.
This is fantastic. We're just letting you go for it.
It's like Kindle, you know, right there on your computer with all your highlights and stuff.
It really is. And just knowing that you have the ability to then sort of repackage the notes that you made for yourself and put them in a package that makes sense is so much nicer than being like, okay, great. There's this book. I can go back and refer to it. But then how do I make sense of what I want to see out of there? So I think that's great. I mentioned Hine Online earlier, and I do want to point out one very interesting feature in it that I think also maybe doesn't necessarily make your research more efficient. It does in some ways, but I think it makes it way more powerful, is a feature in Hine Online that's called Scholar Check. And this is very similar to shepherdizing for case law. So it will allow you to see what other articles have cited to your article that you're interested in, or you know how many articles have cited to it. That might indicate that it's something that you really want to take a look at because it's considered to be important, groundbreaking, noteworthy. Okay, so I'm looking at Hine Online, and within our subscription are a lot of sort of sub-subscriptions. I mentioned our law reviews and law journals because that's kind of the meat of what we, and the main reason that we subscribed, but there are a lot of other things in here that you might find interesting. A lot of federal sort of congressional and presidential documents, Supreme Court documents, things like that. A lot of primary federal documents, but really, you know, our law journal library is kind of what people are interested in. In the search bar for Hine Online, it makes it very easy for you to, I don't have a citation on hand, so I'll just probably search for something for an author, but it makes it very easy for you to search and target your search. So I'm in the search bar, and let's see if we can find some articles from Chief Justice Hecht. So when I fill that in, it has some suggestions depending on what it thinks you might be looking for. So we can search for his name under author. Title would be the title of the article. Citation, if I had a citation here, I could pop it in and it would pull that article right up for me. And then the catalog, I believe these are the names of the law reviews and journals. So rather than the individual article, the name of the whole work. So we're going to search for him as author. It pre-creates this advanced search for us. And what we will see, I'm going to find a good one, but on the right-hand side here, you'll see the scholar check. For an article, he wrote a foreword that looks like for another article in St. Mary's Law Journal. And scholar check is telling us that this is cited by 9 other articles. So this then, when we go to scholar check, it is going to list all of the articles that cited to our initial article. So it expands our network of research. It allows us to continue that line of thought and trace it through history, see how it had an impact on other scholarship or other jurisprudence. It can be really interesting. And like I said, if an article is cited many times, that may be a signal to you that this is something especially significant that you want to take a look at. It does allow you to, up at the top, there's a sort by. It allows you to sort by number of times that this article is cited by other articles. It allows you perhaps to select the most cited author, indicating perhaps that this particular author is a notable figure, a significant jurist, things like that. You might want to see the newest article. It allows you to sort by that too. So depending on your research goals, it can organize this for you in a way that allows you to take that next step. So I think ScholarCheck is super cool. I love that they have taken that sort of shepherdizing concept and transferred it here, because it really makes it much easier to find this line of thought and then and trace it and see sort of the impacts that it's made.
It could be the legal equivalent of searching up yourself on Google.
Yeah.
Wonder who cited my comment.
You absolutely can. You can search by author and then see of my articles. Who's citing to it? You know, things like that. It's really, really interesting.
You talk mostly about law journals and that sort of thing in Hind. So it's really mostly, I think, about legal scholarship as opposed to, say, somewhere along the way you mentioned like the Texas Bar Journal and some other publications or legal news, not legal newspapers per se, but how far does it go? I mean, is it like Texas Lawyer or something like that?
I don't think it has Texas Lawyer. So I think it's pretty... I'm not sure how they sort of draw their parameters, but the bar journals would be national. So all bar journals across the country, because you can go into each database and there is an explanatory guide for it. If you're in Hind and you're not sure perhaps what this encompasses or how to best use it, you will note. So here, looking at Hind Online, you'll see this sort of research, the breadcrumbs across the top showing that we're in databases, we're currently looking in the Law Journal Library. There's both this little I giving you a very, very broad overview of what's contained in it. So here, this is of the journals, there's almost 3,500 different titles, 92,000 volumes, and 50 million pages. But this LibGuide is here. This is written by the people at Hind that go into much more detail about what is in here. So it might show you specifically what's in there. It might give you information on updates to it, recent additions. It's a very nice sort of snapshot about what you might be able to find within it.
Well, that's a great resource.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah, Hind is great. I love sort of singing their praises because not only are they excellent at what they do, you know, the organization, the user friendliness is just great, but they're just like the nicest people. Like I said, it's like family-owned company, and they go to great pains to be responsive and, you know, helpful for us services. So I love giving them the attention and the credit that they're due.
I guess, what are the things that you think are underutilized that you wish more people knew about and would use at the library?
I would say definitely, although this is, you know, starting to come around, all of the dictionaries that we have. I think I briefly mentioned earlier that we had a big collection of dictionaries, but we didn't really have a sort of systematic way to show people exactly which ones we have and, you know, what time periods they might be covering. That's another thing that we get questions about on a, if not daily, weekly basis, is that I need a contemporaneous definition of this term for this sort of year. And we've got a lot. We've got, like I said, we went through the list that's in one of the appendices of Reading Law by Scalia and Garner, and took all the lists of the general language dictionaries and the legal dictionaries. you know, we have Blacks going back to the first edition, and specifically pointed out where one might find them within the context of our collection. So whether we have them in print, there are some that are available more widely on the web, we link to those. So knowing that people can access that through us, I think is really helpful. What else is underutilized that I wish people knew more about? Hyen is one of the ones that I think, you know, for library nerds like ourselves, whenever I tell people that it's there, you know, eyes light up, and just knowing the sheer scope of what's within it is really impressive. The thing that I think I wish people would utilize the most are our librarians. We are always up for a challenge. We're always up for, we like weird questions, but also most importantly, especially for newer practitioners, no question is a dumb question. We are happy to help you get started. We are happy to help explain things to you. We know that it's confusing. We know that it can be hard. We are here to not judge and just to help and make you look like magic. I really, really do want to encourage that listeners should please feel free to reach out to us. We accept questions by phone, 8 to 4:45, I think is when our phones cut off, Monday through Friday. We accept questions online through our website, which again is www.sll.texas.gov. And currently in the upper right-hand corner, you will see a box, I think, that says questions, ask us, please do. So you can submit a question through the web there. And we are in the process of rolling out text messaging.
Ooh, look out.
Yeah. So we are waiting to get our text messaging number, but then you will be free to text us day or night. We will text you back because we know a lot of people access our website from a mobile device. So we're wanting to make sure that we can reduce as much friction as possible between people having a question and getting that question to us. The wheels are turning. I hope that by the end of May, that will be live, but keep checking that questions page because we will put that text messaging number up there as soon as it's ready to go.
Appellate filing requires precision. A small mistake could derail your case. That's why you need Counsel Press, trusted by 100% of the Am Law 100 firms since 1938. Whether it's e-brief preparation, indexing, or electronic filing, they provide complete support, ensuring every document meets the highest standards of accuracy and compliance. Their dedicated team of appellate counsel and paralegal specialists guide your case through every step. From review to filing, Counsel Press has your back. Visit counselpress.com to learn how they can support your next appeal. I mean, I know it probably varies depending on the question, but just turnaround times on average, like if someone calls, how quickly can they expect an answer or not? Just because attorneys love to wait till the last minute to do things.
Yeah, our goal is to respond to somebody within one business day. And we are pretty good about doing that. The only exceptions are maybe if there's maybe some back and forth and we need clarification or things like that. But you should expect to hear back from us within a business day. Don't wait until the last minute. And we're closed on weekends. So,
okay. So don't wait until the last minute to call the library and start early.
We can't help you with a pressing research question at, you know, 2 a.m. on a Sunday, but we will get back to you on Monday.
Are y'all seeing an uptick in the number of pro se litigants coming to you for research help?
You know, I don't necessarily think that there has been an uptick in that. It has been steady. What we have seen has been some changes in our usage statistics. Our website's maybe getting less hits, interestingly, and we think that's because of AI, because Google's AI overview is taking our content and presenting it in that AI overview. You know, our phone calls have gone down a little bit, and we see that as potentially being because of AI maybe, but also I think these days people are less comfortable with picking up the phone and making a phone call. So that's one reason we're introducing text, is to maybe get some of the younger people who are growing up, didn't really grow up making phone calls, but are, as they're becoming adults, are running into legal questions. So we want to be able to make sure that we're able to communicate them with them in a way that they prefer and feel comfortable with. Because if you're a non-lawyer and you're having to reach out to a law library, something's probably going not great for you in your life. And so you're stressed out, you're upset. And the last thing you want to do is have to get even more outside of your comfort zone. So we're cognizant of that and trying to make it as easy for people. But just in the terms, the sheer number of pro se litigants, I don't necessarily think that's the case. We have seen a steady demand for a long time. No signs of abating. Yeah.
That makes sense. I think we're seeing sort of a proliferation of self-represented litigants using AI. I don't want to suggest that they should all be calling you, but
they truly should. We recognize that AI can be a powerful tool and the horse has left the barn. We're not going to roll that back. So now the question is, how can we help people use it responsibly? How can we help them verify their citations? How can we help them find supporting material that either confirms or disproves what AI told them? It's a great starting point. There's a lot of additional, it's not the end point. So, I mean, please, I never discourage anybody from calling us. I want to say, use us more, call us more, because we're always happy to help with that. And in that, AI has so much promise for self-represented litigants, but it also has so much potential for problem. And if we can help them forestall those problems, like, we absolutely want to do that. It will be for the benefit of everybody, for them, for the judge, you know, for the opposing party. Just everybody wins out if we're not cluttering the courts with AI hallucinations.
As a practical thought on that, if there's a self-represented litigant who says, I want to file a motion for summary judgment in a TCPA case, you know, there's resources that would be available through you all that would go far beyond what they can find, you know, things that are copyrighted and shouldn't be available, at least through a general AI search. You could steer them towards, we talked about Dorsenio earlier, you know, as a resource. It's like, okay, I'll take my tongue out of my cheek now and agree with you that I would hope that pro se litigants would contact state law library for help, because I think it could help moderate some of the sort of off-topic filings, shall we call them, that get put into court files because people just don't know and they can't afford a lawyer. And so they take what ChatGPT generates for them, you know, slap it in a Word document and file it. If they even had like a basic form to go off of, that would, I think, would tremendously potentially improve their product. And as you say, Amy, save everybody time and trouble because we're not having them to respond to things that really aren't relevant.
You know, AI is being sold to everybody as this magic solution, this silver bullet that'll fix everything for them. And it's not quite that. So we're, you know, I'm part of a working group with some other law librarians across the country to develop a best practices guide for self-represented litigants using AI. If you're going to do it, and people will, how can you do it well? How can you do it effectively? How can you do it responsibly? So we're all seeing this and we're all kind of trying to say, how can we manage this? What can we do to support it? It can be so useful for a lot of things. It can be so bad and dangerous for a lot of other things.
I do have just one side question that I'm curious about. What is the most interesting or random request you've ever gotten for research?
I love these questions. We actually have a full moon calendar in our break room, you know, like an astrology person, but I would swear that things get a little weirder when there's a full moon. There was a weird stretch one year where we had like a cluster of like interference with a corpse questions like coming up at once. Just all of a sudden, it was like we had several people who this was on their mind sort of at the same time.
Just to put this out there real quick, when people call you, it's not privileged. And if you've got confidential client information and you share it with them, you may violate your ethical rules. So just be clear on that.
Now, this is interference like a tort. We're not talking about how to dispose of a body. We're talking about how to... I thought you were talking about a tort claim.
No, corpse. Yeah, that their like loved one's body had gone to one funeral home, but then another relative said that they had the rights over it, and so they took it. I mean, there was all sorts of... It was like a very strange multiple questions about that at once. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, one of the most fun things that we've done was... The local Austin NPR station has a series called ATX Explain, where listeners can submit a question and then the reporters will report on it. And a seventh grade class submitted a question about like, what are the weirdest laws in Texas? You know, much credit to the reporter, they came to us. And so we pretty much had all of the librarians getting to be like, what's the weirdest question you've ever gotten? And we got to put them all together. And my favorite one, my favorite sort of little factoid from that was not a law per se, but an administrative rule is that the Secretary of State in, I think, determining, you know, voting, where you can vote, specifically included a section stating that if astronauts are in orbit on election day, they can vote from space, knowing that Houston has a space industry. I thought that was super cool. But one of the funnier questions that we used to get a lot, actually, was some sort of variation of, am I married? because of common law marriage. People would not know the sort of three-prong test, and they would have someone saying like, oh, my ex-girlfriend is saying that we were actually married, and now, you know, am I married? So that was kind of a fun, very, very common question.
Well, I mean, that segues right into the tip or war story that I'm now going to ask you for. This is great. And now we've added the element of video such that we're, you know, encouraging folks to check out the episode on YouTube to see exactly what you took us through, which was great. But do you have as a parting thought, do you have a tip or a war story to wrap us up on for the listeners and viewers?
I may need to think a little bit more on the war story.
A tip is great. I mean, something we haven't talked about.
I am always kind of up for, like I said, we're up for a challenge. So we don't ever really see things as, you know, trials we were put through. But as far as tips, I would say if you're in Austin, you know, come stop by and walk around and you see if there's things that, you know, jump out at you, and see how you can use our conference room, see how you can use our scanners. Like I said, we have all of this great stuff in print, Dorsenio's, Wright Miller, all the sort of Matthew Bender, Texas practice material. Come take stock and see if there's stuff that you can bookmark in your mind for later that you can call on us to send to you. All the Black's Law dictionaries, the Prince's legal abbreviations thing, you know, we've got a lot of stuff that just kind of take it in, and it might kind of get the wheels turning for you later about how we can be of use to you. I recognize that a lot of your listeners probably aren't in Texas, so do the same thing on our website. You know, go click around, go poke around and see, visit our recommended books page. You might be surprised what we have that we can make available to you. So just kind of, you know, do a quick tour. Like I said, it might kind of inspire things or at least plant a seed in your mind for later.
Well, Amy, you've really helped us out by explaining just what it is that you all do. So many of us know, hey, the State Law Library is there. We've actually visited, but it's such a great reminder, especially hearing it from you as the executive director. You're there, what you do, and even, you know, you've educated us a lot about things that wouldn't even thought of that you do. So thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Oh yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I love talking shop. I think it's really fun and interesting. And like I said, you know, come try to stump us. We're up for it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.